Welcome to In Front of Ira.
With Sabrina.
And Torsten.
Two historians.
And friends.
And lovers.
Of romantic comedies.
And this is the podcast in which we answer the age-old question.
Will they? Or won't they?
Is it or isn't it a romantic comedy?
Those are two really good questions. And I think we should try and answer them.
Yeah, sure. Which I think for this one should be easy enough because it is Nora Ephron's Sleepless in Seattle from 1993. And I think we can just go ahead and say that is a romantic comedy. That is not going to be the point of debate per se, but yeah.
Yeah, although it did start its life as a romantic drama. It did not start off as a comedy. True, yeah. So... it's certainly a question that makes sense to ask, even if the answer is clear. So yeah, Sleepless in Seattle. Shall we just get right into it? The plot of Sleepless in Seattle is kind of well known. It's kind of one of those by now cliche because it's a Nora Ephron romantic comedy plots. We have Meg Ryan, who is Annie Reed and lives in Baltimore and works as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun and is about to be married to the, in this movie, amazingly funny Bill Pullman, Walter. She does not really feel like she should be marrying Walter, so he is the original boyfriend she should not be with, TM. And on the other hand, we have Tom Hanks, who has a son named Jonah. His name in this is Sam, and he is, I think he's an architect or something like that. It's never really quite made clear what he does when he does it.
Because there's that, like, he dates one of the people he's redesigning a house for, so I think he's an architect.
Oh, yeah. And oh, he talks about it, yeah.
Rob Reiner is his friend who also seems to be working with him.
In, like, architecture. And he starts out in... Chicago. There's this wonderful shot that kind of starts the movie off where they bury Tom Hanks's wife in this movie and Jonah's mother, and then it cranes up and you see the Chicago skyline. And then he moves to Seattle for reasons that are never entirely explored, except that Seattle
is Seattle, they don't tell you, but obviously he moves because he's trying to start off, like, start fresh, go somewhere new to get away from all the memories of his wife and his life there. So why Seattle? Nobody knows.
And then the rest of the movie finds him living in Seattle in a Seattle floating home, which is kind of a nice touch.
Which is funny. Like, it is clearly, like, a floating home in the sense of it's a house built on the sea, but, like, some sources refer to it as a houseboat, which for me is a very different thing if you've been to Amsterdam. But that also will bring me to Ted Lasso, which at some point I do will have to talk about. But I think that was funny to me because I never thought of him living in anywhere that isn't a normal house. If you think, I mean, like, look closer, that seems to be a thing. But it seems to have been a deliberate aesthetic choice.
It's technically a boat, I guess. But that's a Seattle thing, which I just recently learned was, like, a huge thing, or still is a huge thing, that there are quite a few of them. Because if you look at the map, how Seattle is set up, there's a lot of water, and there's a lot of places to put this home. This specific floating home, not that this is important to the movie, I recently also learned when I was researching this, was in 2014. I'm not sure if this is still current, bought by one of those, like, tech executives for over $2 million. So in the 90s, successful architect Tom Hanks, not crazy rich Tom Hanks architect, could still afford this. Today, probably not so much.
Yeah, today Seattle, I think, is still too close to Silicon Valley. Like, people keep spreading out towards it. I know it's not really close, but it feels like a lot of people, like, trying to get away from massively expensive.
Right?
Yeah, and then
Microsoft,
of course, Microsoft.
Thing. Yeah.
But, like, given the Bay Area is literally becoming unaffordable for anyone but, like, Tim Apple. Tip Cook. is the thing. So yeah, this is what takes us to Seattle, and then obviously the big plot device for getting them together is this radio call-in radio show with Dr. Marcia Fieldstone that Sam's son Jonah calls in because his dad is sad because his mother died and he feels like he should have a new wife. And Annie is driving, I forget where she's driving to, but it's for Christmas. She's going home for Christmas.
This is a thing. This is a question I have that maybe you can answer, because I watched this movie twice within the last 24 hours, once standalone, once with the director's commentary. I could not for the life of me figure out what makes her drive alone from this Christmas function where she was together with Bill Pullman, with Walter, and then to another thing where they're supposed to show up together. Is this just people generally always drive in separate cars culture thing that I'm not understanding because I don't live in that place? Or is it just a plot device? Because it feels weird that they're just not going together. If they're going from one Christmas thing to another Christmas thing together, that they could just be in the same car.
This is just me being European. They explained that they have to split up after and then drive separately from there, I think. And then it also feels like the car might be very full with like presents for the 50 million people that are at the place. So maybe that's bad. But yeah, so certainly I think it is also important, obviously, for her to be alone in the car for plot reasons. But also I think the general separation from her and Bill Pullman the whole time, like they never feel together. It is also insane to me to make Bill Pullman the guy you're not supposed to be with that has the 50 allergies, because it's Bill Pullman. Like, I don't know.
But that's why it works. He's so incredibly funny and like, charming in it.
Yeah, but it like, I mean, Greg Kinnear was that too, but like in the ranks of like 90s film hunks, and I'm saying Greg Kinnear because of You've Got Mail, but like it's Bill Pullman. Like, I mean, I'm the weird kid who watched Spaceballs before I ever saw any Star Wars. So I, like, before I had a crush on Harrison Ford, I had a crush on Bill Pullman. So it's... and then also the fact that one of my favorite movies of all time is League of Their Own. And in this, he's obviously Gina Davis's husband who comes back from the war and is clearly, like, the more hunky.
I feel like they kind of went to Tom Hanks too, right?
I mean, like Gina Davis and Tom Hanks never really have a thing there. I think they're meant to be platonic, but there's certainly like a bit of a flirty energy between them, but it's clear she's married. And then he also meets the husband at some point. And in this case, clearly Bill Pullman wins out, right? I mean,
I feel like they really went to A League of Their Own for most of their casting.
Rosie O'Donnell is apparently, Rosie O'Donnell is Meg Ryan's best friend. She's sort of one of the early like snarky best friends. Obviously when Harry Met Sally, we have Carrie Fisher. So, you know, but like apparently they went for a comedian specifically, and Rosie O'Donnell's film debut had been A League of Their Own just before, and she wanted to have a comedian in this because Whoopi Goldberg had done Ghost and got did she win the Academy Award for this, or was she just nominated? But anyway, like, I mean, Whoopi Goldberg and Ghost was a big thing, and so Nora Ephron was like, hey, let's bring in someone with like comedic chops for this part to kind of get some of the funny in.
Speaking of comedic chops, the cast of this movie, even the ones who did not star in A League of Their Own, are just really, really funny comedic actors. I mean, they might also be non-comedic actors, but they are really, really funny in this. And it's, of course, Rita Wilson, Tom Hanks's wife, gets cast as his
sister-in-law.
Sister or sister-in-law?
No, I think she's the sister. But
no,
I'm not
No. I think Victor. So Victor Garber is the brother. Because
they just read up something where she's. It doesn't matter.
Because Nora Ephron says in the director's commentary that Victor Garber's hair matched Tom Hanks's, and that's why she thought they were believable. So
maybe. So then they're brothers, and then she's the sister-in-law.
Yeah. Also really funny.
Stacked cast, like Victor Garber. I mean, I know, like, Victor Garber's also a stage actor, so maybe, like, he isn't... I mean, he did Alias for a while, so that's where I first know him from, but he's one of those people who's just been in a lot of things, and he's always great.
David Hyde Pierce is Meg Ryan's brother.
Yeah.
And he has one really, really good scene where he says that iconic line about the neuroses that match up.
Yeah, but it's just neuroses matching up, like falling in love.
It's like, wait, is it subconsciously? I have too many notes. I need to look this up again. Neuroses.
When you're attracted to someone, it just means, hang on. Like, I've quoted this so much and I keep forgetting. When you're attracted to someone, it just means that your subconscious is attracted to their subconscious subconsciously.
Subconsciously.
So what we think of as fate is just two neuroses knowing that they're a perfect match.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is also the thing, like, I mean, we've discussed, like, Jewish tradition of rom-com where it's just, oh, the male lead needs to figure out his neuroses. And I think Nora Ephron actually, like, broadened that to, like, the female lead also has to figure out her neuroses, so it is very much in
that's
that
the invention of,
like,
of that, this movie.
That is just, no. I mean, like, she obviously with Harry Mazzelli, that's there too, but I think this is just clearly stated. Like, that's sort of Nora Ephron's mission statement. The other mission statement for this apparently was because there's that meta line that Rosie O'Donnell has that is less like, you don't want to be in love, you just want to be in love in a
movie. In the movies, yeah.
And Nora Ephron apparently said at some point, yeah, she, like, wants to kind of make one of the films that make people weird about love and, like, want the thing that you see in the movies. And she clearly succeeded because it's one of those films people think of when they want that.
The meta aspect is really
mysterious,
there's
soulmate connection.
There's a little featurette on the DVD/Blu-ray/iTunes publication of this movie where they talk about kind of this being the first movie that uses that kind of meta movie references, which can't possibly be true, but it may have been one of the really like first big ones that put that out there. Because what I remember from this movie, from seeing it at some point in the 90s, was her and Rosie O'Donnell talking about old movies. So it's certainly something, and it's referenced in terms of, you know, that generation remembering the movies that they saw more than they remember the books they read, which today just sounds like what else is new? But maybe at the time was still newish enough.
It is sort of like the quote from when Harry Mazzelli is like, what magazines are to people. Like,
yeah.
That's sort
movies
of
are the quiche of the 90s.
90s, yeah. And A Fair to Remember is obviously also the 1957 film is a big influence on the plot structure of the movie. It also steals the, like, meeting of the Empire at the Empire State Building. But obviously that's in, again, it's like this meta thing in the film where they talk about this is the most romantic movie for women, like, especially of this generation, obviously, having grown up with it and, like, having think that is, like, the epitome of romantic fulfillment.
Yeah. Which apparently was in the first draft already when it was still a drama.
Yeah, so that's credited. So we should say, like, even though Nora Ephron ends up with the main writing credit and she directed it, there's a guy called David Ward and a guy called Jeff Arch that were also involved in writing.
Yeah, David Ward is, I think, kind of better known. He also wrote The Sting, won an Academy Award for that one. And Jeff Arch isn't really all that well known. I did not actually know him. I looked up the things he'd done and then still did not know him. But he obviously came up with this movie.
Yeah, so the Wikipedia article in this is actually pretty detailed and has a lot of sources. But I also just read, I haven't finished it yet, that book. I'll have what she's having about Nora Ephron's romantic comedies, and I'm currently blanking on the author, and the book is in the next room, but apologies there, it's a great book. And they talk about that, and apparently, so he was just working as an English teacher at the time. Like, it's not like he hadn't written anything, but he hadn't, like, written a screenplay that actually got made. He ended up writing this, like, had this idea, sent it to a producer he happened to know as a spec, and that producer pushing it on and was like, you know, like, apparently it was also like, this is something, there's something here, we should get this to the right people. And then somehow
the writers that we know of then are Jeff Arch, it is wait, what was his name again? I just forgot.
Jeff Arch is the struggling writer, and then David Ward was involved at some
point. Ward was the second one. Efron was the third one. And then while the movie was happening, she hired her sister, Delia Efron, to basically just deal with on-set rewrites. So there's like at least four writers involved in this. And for it being a movie that has four writers involved in it, it is shockingly like on point. I think
that's also just Efron and her sister. So her and her sister end up doing You've Got Mail together later. So I think that's the first time she really starts working with
her. It's Delia Efron's like second movie ever. So she's kind of new to the game.
She's done other writing before, and also know this from the book. Like there's some history there, the family history in that book too. They all come together. Apparently, like, interestingly, because, I mean, all the gender cliches of, like, oh, you know, women are the sappy ones, as it's stated in the movie. Apparently, Jeff Archer's draft of this was much more melodramatic and much more leaning into sort of the magical aspects of soulmate connection, et cetera, whereas Nora Ephron then took it and tried to make it more funny and really turn it into rom-com. For me, the funniest scene is actually a scene that ended up being improvised by the actors, which is when Tom Hanks and Victor Garber...
The Dirty Dozen.
Act out the Dirty Dozen and make fun of the fact that the women tear up but just recount, like, they're calling...
Because Rita Wilson has just, in her role, narrated An Affair to Remember to them and kind of teared up. Which is also her perfect, great one scene in this movie, if you've never seen Rita Wilson, really, like, if you know Rita Wilson as, oh, she's Tom Hanks's wife, and you've never really seen her in anything, just go watch that one scene and you know why she is great. She's just completely killing
it. She's one of those actresses who never, like, I don't know where she's, if she ever was like the lead in any, probably not anything I've seen. I don't know if have blanks there, but it feels like she's usually someone who gets hired in like a supporting role, but then like shines in the supporting role.
I think she does a lot of like behind the scenes kind of stuff. So
yeah, I mean, by now her and Hanks have a production company. They produce Mamma Mia. They produce a bunch of other things.
Wedding. Yeah, everything that has people attached to it. So yeah. Rita Wilson is great in this. Let's just we're gonna have to move on,
and Victor Garber.
Victor Garber is also, each of them basically get like one scene, which is the same scene in which they get to show all their talents. Otherwise they're just there for kind of color, for like making the world believable, which is fine as well.
And I mean, it also makes sense that they have chemistry together, because Rita Wilson and Tom Hanks are literally married to each other, and Victor Garber is great. And I mean, I don't know if they're friends in real life. I wouldn't be surprised if they are. He's gay. At the time he was an out, he came out very late, but like he seems to be in this like theater actor. Like you can put him with anyone and he will have chemistry with a wall. Like
And you mentioned that most of this scene between Hanks and Garber was improvised, and Efron says in the director's commentary that they could have shot like basically a 2-hour movie of them reenacting the Dirty Dozen, which I kind of want to see. I kind of want to see that. Really funny movie, which brings me to a thing that actually I think really, really is about where you are in your life and when you watch movies and what they mean to you. I first saw this movie in the 90s, in my teenage years. I probably saw the German dub. I probably saw it on television.
Same.
I did not think it was especially funny at all. I thought it was, cute, like, love story, dramatic. All of the really, really funny humor in, like, the small things that you kind of get once you've, you know, lived a little, once you've, you know, had to fend for your own livelihood, once you've been in relationships, once you've just know people out in the world and how the world works, completely passed me by. Didn't understand it, didn't think it was funny, just thought it was kind of sappy and certainly not as good as When Harry Met Sally. And this time around, I genuinely understood.
Yeah, I also had exactly the same experience. I think we do also have to, like, the German dub might have just fucked up some of the actually funny bits, and then I didn't come back to it.
Yeah, I feel like
for a long time.
The German voice of Hanks, I think, always does like a really good job of kind of channeling.
Yeah, but then also the voice actor is not the person translating the script, yeah. So it's probably just a bad translation. But also, I'm with you also again about like, when do you see this? Because, I mean, I rewatched it very recently for this, but also because I was writing a paper where I needed it. And then, but I had watched it, I think, last fall on the plane because it was there and was like, I haven't seen this in so long and like, I want to watch it. And I also thought it was really funny and funnier than I remembered. Like, I also had this saved as like, oh, this is way more sort of like, you know, in between When Harry Met Sally, that's really funny. Mm. And then you've got Mail, that's definitely also has some of those one-liners, yeah. Or you know, it's just situationally funny, but this is like, yeah, it's funny,
yeah, going in. I actually
David Hyde Pierce also,
yeah, going in, I actually like our initial like, this is clearly a rom-com, going in, I actually was wondering if that was going to be true for it. It very quickly turned out that yes,
yeah.
But going in, I did not remember it that way. And it's yeah, and it's not, I think the humor just isn't made for, you know, like 10-year-olds or teenagers or like the people who would be watching this with their parents in some fashion. It is clearly made for people the age of Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks and Bill Pullman and like all the other actors, like the adults in the movie. And
yeah.
At that point, you understand the humor.
And I think, yeah, the humor, again, it's just the stuff about like neuroses and that kind of thing. And then Bill Pullman having 50 million allergies and like stuff like that. It's just, you know, or her making fun of like Dr. Marcia Fields. And it's like, Dr. Marcia, and like all of that stuff. And Rosie O'Donnell, again, like, was specifically hired to also have her be funny with that and sort of balance out some of the more the sappiness of, like, Annie as a character also. And I also like that this, I mean, it's interesting to me looking at, like, reviews of it. By the way, it has a 75% Rotten Tomatoes rating.
It's a good one. I think it's also, like, 6.8 on IMDb, which is above the typical.
I had thought it would have aged worse for me watching it, but then also for reviewers rewatching it, which apparently also happened during the pandemic. But there's like also a 30 years later, because it turned 30 last year from The Guardian. And like generally people are still like, this is a contrived thing. We all know this going in. That's actually fine. But like people don't seem to think it aged badly, which does happen a lot. So like this,
yeah, the internet like, obviously has opinions. Like if you're going to find like you've got male criticism, people are, like the whole idea, like let's kind of like dive right into
you've
that.
Because male is worse though. We're going to get to
very
that
much season. Worse. Yeah.
But
but like this whole premise of her kind of trying to figure out who he is and then going to visit him in Seattle. And people obviously these days, especially like, you know, considering everything since that has occurred, consider that kind of like a creepy stalkery kind of thing, which I can see. And it's clearly not played for that, which you can fault the movie for. But it does in the end not, like it doesn't really amount to her being overly creepy. She's in like the same city. She's across the street from them. She watches them from afar. She can't get it together, and she kind of leaves again. It's not.
Yeah. And otherwise, she responds to Jonah, who specifically goes on the radio and says, "Like, get in touch." So she does.
Yeah. So she has a reason for being there, and even though it is, it just feels much more like it's kind of a, you know, a lovelorn person who can't get it together enough to actually talk to their crush or something. That's kind of more the idea that you get from it.
And also like her sort of online stalking, trying to find him, using her because she's a journalist, right? Like using the resources she has. Also today, like, I mean, how many people sort of do social media stalking, if you want to call it that, on people?
She's way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, that's what that was surprising to me, because now she would simply like scroll through his whole Instagram or like try to find other accounts. And I think we all do that to a certain degree, at least if you're on your social media yourself. because it's the one point of reference we have for a person, right? It's just trying this.
Yeah.
And people make the information publicly available. If you lock your account, then you don't. But if your account is open, you know people can see all of that.
Yeah. So the interesting thing...
That's different, obviously, but still, it's, yeah.
The interesting thing about this is because the director's commentary is clearly from after You've Got Mail was done, which is referenced by Efron in the director's commentary. She references that all these DVDs, now we can do these commentaries. So this is late 90s when she does that. And she specifically references
2000s, right?
That, we wouldn't have that the movie is kind of about everyone living in the same place, even though they're not living physically in the same place. So because television and radio connect us, and now the internet, which then did not exist, which they kind of like do. She makes like this funny mention, we didn't even have search engines like Yahoo then. I'm like, oh yeah, that's dating yourself, right? But that's kind of a very prescient movie, and I think potentially why people today still respond to it, because it really posits that space isn't quite that important, and that's not an idea that at the time I think is all that recognized. We still have like the whole kind of academic discussion of it, you know, what is nationhood with the whole Andersonian imagined community, you know, like we are together as a nation because we use the same media kind of thing, so we are living in a sense in the same space, but in like a very real sense, in a sense of, you know, you logging onto the internet and talking to people from across the world, that didn't in that sense exist there. And it did exist in this niche thing of these call-in shows that were nationally syndicated. And that is really an interesting vehicle for them to be using.
Yeah, and then obviously You've Got Mail sort of builds on that, because then suddenly online fora like and AOL email and all of that stuff exists.
Which actually explains... This movie explains, like, that explanation of hers, which may also be kind of, like, retroactive because she made You've Got Mail, but the trajectory seems kind of clear, right? It's a movie about connection and not necessarily people in the same place.
Yeah, there's actually, like, that's also linked on the, like, quoted on the Wikipedia on this, but, like, apparently someone had written, Eric Thomas had written for Elle magazine during the COVID-19 pandemic, sort of rewatching this and going, oh, you know, it's who amongst us isn't rediscovering the telephone during this time, and even small distances seem yawning, or the simple pleasure of a mailed letter. Thank you to all the post office employees. After grueling 3 years during which the dark underbelly of nostalgia was used to prop up the worst aspects of this country's history and present, it's particularly heartening to be reminded that sometimes the hallmarks of the past can continue to help us. So, like, he's definitely tapping into this idea that's in there, that it's ways of connection that at that point was used because there weren't any other ones. But then also still, like, thinking about these kinds of things. And I think, call-in radio still exists, too, right? It's always the thing where we're thinking of these things as being having been replaced. And to a certain degree, they have. Like, now you'd probably put something up on a Reddit thread or, like, whatever, or, like, Quora or whatever Jonah might use, even... Or, like, just tweet it out. Or, like, I mean, he's too young for all of this. But, like, just use any kind of social media. But it's still, I mean, yeah. Also, like, I don't know where to put this in this podcast. I'm going to jump to it because I'm just looking right at it. But my favorite trivia I learned yesterday is that this film introduced most Americans to tiramisu.
Yes. She makes, Nora Ephron makes a reference to that in the commentary, that she's very happy that she got to share her tiramisu recipe with America after this.
And it's because of a line Rob Reiner has, and I forget what the actual line is, but it's like a euphemism.
They're meeting in a bar or something, in a restaurant, and they're talking. And this is one of those, like, the Rob Reiner, Tom Hanks scene is, like, basically... It's very much, a lot of it is improvised, and it feels like directly lifted out of When Harry Met Sally, which makes perfect sense considering, well, Reiner. But he basically mentions tiramisu to Tom Hanks, and Tom Hanks is very out of it and basically asks, like, what is tiramisu? And Rob Reiner says, like, you'll find out. And he's like, what if a woman wants me to do it to her? And I'm just like,
yes,
great. This is such a great... I mean, not a thing that really would fly, like, 3 years after this, but sure.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's a funny line, and also fits Efron perfectly because she's like a food writer, right? As well, yeah. and
her novel is the Quiche of the 90s.
Yeah, and Heartburn has recipes in it and whatever. And like, but I need to read this out now because sorry to read from Wikipedia, but Sleepless in Seattle is credited with introducing most Americans to tiramisu, which had been a relatively obscure dessert before 1993, which is really funny to me, because in Germany, at least in Bavaria, where I am, very close to the Italian border, we were eating tiramisu when I was, in 1993, when I was 4 years old, my mom would make tiramisu anyway. Rob Reiner's character Jay mentions tiramisu during a conversation with Sam about dating, which Sam mistakes a euphemism for a sexual act. Jay does not clarify that tiramisu is actually an Italian dessert. The conversation caused much interest in the dessert throughout America. According to Josie Dellum of The Economist, few Americans have been familiar with the dessert before Sleepless in Seattle, despite America's high Italian population at the time. And I'm like, what were you doing, Italian Americans? After the film's release, several viewers resorted to calling the studio directly to find out what tiramisu is, with TriStar executive Susan Levin reporting they were receiving 20 to 30 phone calls per day about the subject by the first Monday after the film's release. Levin claimed several callers were either disappointed or refused to believe them when they explained that tiramisu is simply a dessert, although some were relieved by the revelation. And then apparently, like, more restaurants started putting it on the menu, but, like, that's so funny. And also actually speaks to the theme of the film in a way, because in 1993, people would call the movie studio. Now you would simply, again, post on any type of social media.
What is tiramisu?
Or put it in a forum. It's like, does anyone know what tiramisu is? And then someone would know because someone would be Italian. So it's like, yeah, it's so funny to me.
It's it's great. Just the scene between Hanks and Reiner. There's actually one thing that I learned from the director's commentary, which I kind of like had a vague sense watching it, but which was confirmed by Nora Ephron, is that they always tried to connect scenes that had Meg Ryan in them with scenes that had Tom Hanks in them, because you don't see them together for most of the movie. And so one way that they did that is the scene with David Hyde Pierce, where she goes meet her brother, David Hyde Pierce, in Baltimore. They used the door that she exits out of that scene out of and transported it to the location where Tom Hanks and Rob Reiner exit before they have their before they walk to the tiramisu restaurant where they and it's just these little connection things which really kind of like emphasize what this movie is about. It's about connecting people across distance in kind of visual ways, in ways that are not so much visual but kind of more in thought. But it does connect people. And that I thought was really interesting. And it's just a little thing. And like a lot of other little things, you wouldn't really notice unless somebody told you. But when they do, it's, it's cool.
And I mean, obviously, so underlying, I mean, this is not the probably not the first film that does this, but it's certainly one of the films that keeps being referenced in this, is again, obviously, that idea of soulmates, but also that idea of connection. And there's this like the Japanese have the imagery of a red string connecting people through life, like an invisible string, which is also a Taylor Swift song for that reason. But like, there's a whole thing that in like modern fandom has come up a lot, like in terms of people shipping things, like couples. And it's really interesting because like, I mean, why I also rewatched this now, like I was writing a paper on Ted Lasso, which isn't out yet, it's in review, but they consider, I said this before, they come back to Nora Ephron, they come back to Sleepless in Seattle, and so there were a lot of people who for the show shipped like Ted and Rebecca getting together and connected it back to a lot of the Ephron that's being referenced, thinking that this is where this was gonna go, this is like romantic comedy. And even though the show very consciously refers to Ephron the whole time, they're not doing this at the end. And I don't need to reiterate my whole paper here, but like, I think what was interesting is specifically about the references to Sleepless in Seattle is that like, that connection then was actually slightly mocked on the show. They brought up the red strings in a very different context. But then also, again, I said the houseboat. Like, so Rebecca actually ends up with this guy she meets mm. in a fateful connection in Amsterdam on a houseboat, spends a night on a houseboat. And they meet again at the end, and that sort of the shot they have is basically the same shot that they have when Sam and Annie finally meet at the end of the film, even with the kid, because he has a little daughter and he has the son. And they also have other references to Sleepless in Seattle, like the therapist on the show. That's actually also very important if we're talking about, the lead has to work through his neurosis, or both of the leads have to work through neurosis. The therapist on the last is called Dr. Sharon Fieldstone.
Oh,
yeah.
I never put that together.
Yeah, like, it's if you start paying attention to it, and also, like, Jason Sudeikis, when he was on Brett Goldstein's podcast, is basically, like, when you get to pick your, like, favorite movie, and, like, the movie you would take up to heaven after you die, and, like, all of these things, and he ends up picking Sleepless in Seattle as the movie he would show in heaven, which just, like, and then his favorite movie is The Poet Society, and once you have That Poet Society, Sleepless in Seattle, and the fact that, like, I think the first film Jason Sudeikis saw in theaters is Mary Poppins, that explains all of Ted Lasso to you immediately. But, like, yeah, Sleepless in Seattle. It's in there. And I think it also speaks to it's one of those things that just gets referenced and sort of has entered, I think.
It's kind of, there's a meta discourse going on, because as Nora and Delia Ephron make clear, they're referencing old movies on purpose, like, because they are cultural touchstones, and they wanted this movie to be kind of a cultural touchstone like that, and it has become this cultural touchstone now, which is now being referenced. So it sits kind of in the middle between the old movies that a lot of these tropes come from, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Even we talk mostly about romantic comedies from after the kind of When Harry Met Sally-driven revival, but we're going to look at some older ones as well. And a lot of the tropes that are introduced there persist. And yeah, so the 80s, 90s Nora Ephron movies are pretty much the connection point between these things, and sometimes very purposefully.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, it's funny. It's sort of that self-fulfilling prophecy of, like, we're trying to make a film that does that and then they succeed. And then, you know, and even You've Got Mail is almost like them doing another version of the same film in certain themes, same actors, similar themes, but
and
then
doing a version of Shop Around the Corner, right? Which is clearly, I mean, the references are, it's not just the references, there's connections that I didn't really understand until I looked into it a little bit. We talked about Moonstruck very recently. Mm-hmm. I think if I look at our schedule, that's the episode that came out before this one. Yeah. And Norman Jewison's son, Kevin Jewison, is the camera operator. He's credited as the camera operator for this. And the director of photography is Sven Nyström, I think. He definitely is the well-known camera operator, even though I now have just kind of blanked on his name, who did Ingmar Bergman's movies. Scenes from A Marriage is shot by him, and he shoots this movie as if it was kind of a Swedish, television movie. Not a lot of lighting, very moody, and it really works for this. It's kind of amazing where all these connections go, right? This is a guy who almost started working. He started working in 1946, like at the era that all of those movies were made.
And I think, I mean, we already said all the actors, like the stack cast, but also them having worked together. And then also, Meg Ryan wasn't actually even the first choice for this. And, like, they ran through several of the other actors. One of the actresses that was asked is also Julia Roberts. Gary Marshall was also thought of to maybe direct this. So we go back to, like, Pretty Woman, which we haven't done yet, but we'll eventually have to do. And, you know, like, all of them always existing at the same time. Meg Ryan had also been in the running for Pretty Woman. So, like, you know, it's the same sort of the ecosystem, obviously, also just at the same time. Those are the famous faces and the famous people doing these genres. And yeah, they always keep coming back to each other, I guess.
Yeah. And there's, it makes sense. I mean, Efron and Meg Ryan, she really does the dialogue that Efron writes, or, you know, like, is responsible for, really well. She's kind of like, I keep thinking of her, like, maybe a weird comparison, as, you know, Bradley Whitford is to Aaron Sorkin. Like, there's just a way that she gets how Nora Ephron writes dialogue, and the physical comedy that's kind of always implied, but it's not really on the page, that you have to get, like, when she hides in the closet with the little stereo and the phone, and then listening to Sleepless in Seattle, right, on the radio.
Yeah. Do we have anything else, or do we, like, sort of want to go to taglines and...
I think there's a couple of things that I just kind of wanted to talk about. The one thing that I think is really well done in this is the kids, which is a thing that a lot of movies always get wrong. The kid is immediately likable, never becomes annoying, even though he does, like, if you're an adult, hella annoying things, right? Just flying across the country. If I was Tom Hanks, I'd be scared shitless. Like, this is just, like, a crazy thing he does. His kind of friend, girlfriend, whatever, that he meets in Seattle, who is very helpfully the daughter of a travel agent. She is played to perfection by Gabby Hoffman.
I was going to bring her up. I mean, Gabby Hoffman did a few things as a child around that time. What is that called? One of the films I loved growing up, but then didn't see for a while because I also only had it, like, taped off German TV. But, like, Four Girls, kind of...
I know which one you mean.
Answer to Stand By Me.
Yeah. I know which one you mean.
She was in that. And then... but I've also seen her as a grown-up. Like, she's still acting.
She's working,
She was on Girls and played this, like, completely crazy sister to Adam Driver, which makes complete sense. Like, she's definitely, like, in her adult career, she clearly seems to pick very sort of, like, eccentric characters, but she's great.
Yeah, she's really good in this, and you can already see she's, like, I think she's 11 when she does this, she's really, really compelling in that little role, and it's kind of crazy for me to think that, you know, the kids from Sleepless in Seattle are in their late 30s, early 40s now as well. Time is weird.
I think with this, I have that perspective of just having seen Gabby Hoffman and knowing she's older than me, obviously. It's also, like, I totally forgot that Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks obviously didn't just do those two films together. They also did two others. One of them was Joe versus the Volcano.
First one they did together, which we still need to do.
Which we probably still need to do after also doing Moonstruck. And then another one that I'm forgetting that they did after that I don't think was, like, a big thing either. But obviously it's one of those, like, well, if they work well together, or it's like, I mean, now, like, Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone having done a bunch of things together because they always work opposite each other.
So there's a couple things that are basically just, like, Torsten watched the director's commentary and really needs to share this because it's kind of delicious.
It's like, tiramisu had to be in there.
First of all, it's a little bit of an odd commentary because it technically says that it's by Nora and Delia Ephron, but they're recorded separately, and it's mostly by Nora with a couple of things thrown in by Delia. And she says that the first scene when we kind of crane over the dead mother in the cemetery, and then there's the view of Chicago, is inspired by that New Yorker cartoon, right? Where you kind of like see the world from the perspective of a New Yorker, which feels very Efron, like everything is kind of like seen through the perspective of a New Yorker, even Chicago. And the way that she told Meg Ryan to play this character, which I think connects perfectly to When Harry Met Sally. I told Meg when we did this movie that she was playing a Republican who'd never had an orgasm.
So, oh my God, yes, I read that somewhere. Like, yeah, okay.
So,
Bill Pullman might have deserved better after all.
Yeah. I kind of want to see the movie that Bill Pullman is in after this, you know, like, because he was pretty chill with her being like, yeah, I guess this doesn't work. Like, he has mother's engagement ring sized for her. And then she's just like, I can't do this. I need to, you know, run to the Empire State Building where the little heart is being displayed and be with Tom Hanks. And he's like, all right, fine. He's like, he was ill-served by this whole movie.
Yeah. And she's like, oh, I have to go. And then... takes the Walter. Taxi. Walter. Is also one of those names, yeah.
One of the funniest scenes where she at some point asks, does anyone ever call you anything but Walter? Mm-hmm. She says, no. After they're at the family Christmas scene with Meg Ryan and David Hyde Pierce and, of course, Bill Pullman is really, really funny. And it's one of those scenes that is such a classic snappy dialogue Nora Ephron scene where you can kind of like see shades of what would later become Gilmore Girls and all those like fast talking things, like the germination of that. It's just everyone is kind of funny, not necessarily because what they're saying is funny, but the way that it's delivered and the way that it's repeated.
There's that moment
Howard and the bees, like this guy who's allergic to bees.
And then the whole thing about, oh, you're getting engaged, we need to open the champagne. It's like, oh, we already opened the champagne, what did we use it for? And then it's like the uncle getting out of prison or something.
It's so good.
And it's so random, but it's like, let's not ask what happened there.
Shout out, since we're talking about all the good actors, to Barbara Garrick, who plays Victoria, the woman that Tom Hanks is not supposed to be with, the woman he starts dating, absolutely hates with the laughs like a hyena is what he says. I watched this twice, and again, like I said, within the last 24 hours, and the first time I think I was completely... I had the exact right reaction. Like, I did not want them to be together. Like, she was just so not right for him. And then the second time around, I was like, how does she actually do that? How does she play this? How does she... Because she's perfectly lovely. Like, you see her, there's nothing wrong with Barbara Garrick. And it's down to her performance of this that it's very, very clear how they're not supposed to be together. And I think it's timing, in the sense that she doesn't time things correctly for, like, they don't have a flow in their conversation, which is really, really nicely done. And she kind of calls out when Tom Hanks' son, when Jonah, basically is very mean to her, and mentions it to Tom Hanks.
What's sometimes, like, oddly, I feel like, I could be off about this, but I was recently thinking about this again, but like, women's comedic performances are sometimes not perceived as such by particularly a male audience, because there seemed to be a certain ignorant male part of the audience that seems to think that if someone does a laugh like this or whatever, it's just how they actually sound. And I was brought to this by once for the millionth time, like just coming across like on Instagram or whatever, an interview with Melissa Roach, from Big Bang Theory, that has this very, very high pitched voice when she's Bernadette in the Big Bang Theory. And obviously does not have this kind of voice at all in real life. She has a very like mid-range speaking voice, very like soothing speaking voice, because she's an actress. And then also Maggie Wheeler on Friends, where everyone's just always Janice, who just didn't have this. And it's always like, I think people, A, obviously tend to be surprised whenever actors use a different voice anyway, but there seems to be another gendered aspect where it's like, oh, they just found this kooky woman with this kooky laugh. And it's like, no, this is a very deliberate comedic performance to make us think that this is the wrong woman for him. Like, you know, it's like trying to turn Bill Pullman into this nerdy guy with the allergies, which again, like, do I buy it? But also he still has a different standing, right? Where he's like, I kind of deserve better. And he gets to stand up for himself a bit more, too. Yeah. But yeah, it's like...
And I have some qualms with this movie, which are basically only kind of around the fact that it's a Nora Ephron movie and it does all the things that Nora Ephron movies always do. She's not, and I mean this in the best way, a writer with, shall we say, like, range. She writes what she knows, which, if you like that, it's great. If not, you're really not going to enjoy this movie. If you don't like any other Nora Ephron movies, or in the case of one colleague that I talked to that I was watching this movie for a podcast for, if you don't like Tom Hanks, obviously you're not going to like this movie. I still have to probably inquire what that's all about.
Doesn't like Tom Hanks.
This is the question I have. It's you're in for a Nora Ephron movie, period. There's absolutely no ifs, whens, and buts. And if you like that, then you're really going to enjoy this one.
Yeah, I think so.
Which is a nice way of saying, if you don't like that, you're not.
Yeah, and I think that it feels like that's where Roger Ebert, like, let's go back to him, because we tend to somehow end up with him.
The ghost of Roger Ebert is hovering over this podcast.
But because he ends his review on Sleepless in Seattle is as ephemeral as a talk show, as contrived as The Late Show, and yet so warm and gentle, I smiled the whole way through. And he was basically also like, well, there isn't much to this other than this is about a soulmate connection. And if you buy that, then move on. Then it's fine. Then you can enjoy it. If you're like so skeptical of that and just hate that kind of trope and you hate that thing, then you're just immediately in the wrong film. And I think that's that. If you want to buy into that conceit, then you're in for a good time. If you don't, then obviously not, because I think that is, it obviously goes back to the spec script by Art, it's the leads don't actually meet for the last 2 minutes of the film. And that is something that, you know, it breaks every rule of rom-com, basically.
Yeah.
But as you said, they're trying to find other ways of making they connect.
And kind of like the little stalkery excursion that Meg Ryan has. And they actually first meet when he sees Barbara Garrick off at the airport. Yeah. Again, like, such a 90s scene, like, he can just walk up to the gate and she is coming out. And Ephron references in the commentary, this is the one scene in the movie where they actually put in a little bit of slow-mo. It's not noticeable if you don't know, but it feels a little bit elevated.
Time slows down.
And magical.
Yeah,
and
kind of
oh
magical.
My God, does Meg Ryan look like kind of romantic comedy stunning in that scene. Like, she is exactly like, because usually the problem that I have with them look across the room and find your soulmate scenes is, you know, you're just looking at a person, like, there's another person there, they might be pretty. It just never really quite buy that, like, the magical moment is happening. I completely buy this one. And it's down to
and they usually do it with someone. They do it very well with Imagine Me and You, which we also had this season.
Yeah.
They have that same slow-mo lock eyes, go back to the flow of the kind of scene bit to sell us on that happening.
Yeah. Just one note, because I have it here and I got the name of the director of photography wrong. It's Sven Nykvist. Justice for Sven.
Also one other thing that I forgot to read out about the tiramisu, but since it just mentioned Roger Ebert in a 2014 interview with RogerEbert.com, so not him anymore, I think, because he had passed, but Rob Reiner dismissed tiramisu as overrated, insisting that he would never order it for himself. So he isn't gonna have what he's having.
That whole family.
I'm glad that someone felt the need to bring this up to Rob Reiner again in 2014 going, so how about that tiramisu?
How about that tiramisu? Yeah.
So tagline, I guess.
Yeah.
The actual tagline for this film is, what if someone you never met, someone you never saw, someone you never knew was the only someone for you?
Hmm. It's good. That's okay. It's not succinct, but at least you know what you're getting into.
Do you have a fake tagline?
I just my go-to for fake taglines is usually quotes from the movie that are kind of taken out of context, and I can't really quite decide between horses. And if it's in the computer, they believe everything, which is what Gabby Hoffman says when
sounds more like you've got me.
That's kind of the thing. It's pointing ahead at that. I could also use microwave 5 minutes, which is what Tom Hanks replies when he completely misunderstands how to basically feed himself when he's grieving of his wife, which is very close to the beginning of the movie where you realize that this is a movie about real grief, but it's also funny and it's hard to do. That's a hard thing to do. So if you like a movie like Sleepless in Seattle, just grab some popcorn, microwave 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the standout quote for me is going to be what we think of as fate is just two neuroses knowing that they are a perfect match, which could have been another tagline. Now I also sort of leaning towards tiramisu is overrated.
The movie that teaches us that tiramisu is overrated, controversially. There's kind of like a thing that I think we need to talk about, because it ends the movie and because it's not something that you would really notice that much today. It's that computer generated shot of the heart on the Empire State Building and pulling back, and the map. The map is like a big thing, like the map of the United States, basically the West Coast and the East Coast connected, constantly referenced. And this kind of pulling back and showing that this whole country is connected, which is both very much on point for the movie, and it also just makes you realize like how much of a US-centric view this whole like Nora Ephron universe is, because Canada doesn't exist, Mexico doesn't exist, it's just the country and the size of the country. The film
is set in Chicago and Seattle, at the end they have to go back to New York.
It's always
for New there York. To be yeah. romance. It's always
to the point weird. Where people on the internet, like there's I think like one of those like core threads, like where does Mick Ryan live in Sleepless in Seattle, and one guy just like very confidently, she lives in New York during the whole movie and that's where they meet. I'm like, no, she's a reporter for the Baltimore Sun, and she lives in Baltimore, and people don't realize that because it's centering New York so much. They shot it apparently in all those various cities, except that the Empire State Building was done in Seattle on a stage because
not fully. So they were at the Empire State Building, they only got like 6 hours to shoot there, so they filmed the actual entrance. She's actually in the lobby and then briefly up with the elevator, but then the last few shots of them when they actually meet the and they clearly thing. Needed more time they recreated that terrace somewhere in
which
Seattle.
I think people are going to be disappointed because I'm pretty sure it looks better than the real thing does.
I've never been up there. I've been to New York so many times. I never went up in the Empire State Building. I think it was a point of like trying not to do the most tourist thing. But I think now I finally need to.
I mean, like after your like fifth time there, you get to.
If I think it's been more than five. So yeah, I think maybe catch up.
All right. Dear listeners, maybe meet us next Valentine's Day on the top of the Empire State Building and see if Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan will join us for that one.